Blog Talk Radio.
Your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, man. Hey, did you get to see that movie, The Martian, this last
week? You know,
we talked about it a little last week.
And I've seen it, so now we can do full spoilers. Okay, if you want to.
Oh, I don't. Do we want to just go full spoiler, or do we want to kind of, you know, just get your not spoiler filled review? What do, you know, which way we want to go with this? I guess we should.
Well, okay, this is a bit of a spoiler, but I think it's just fair. Okay, if you don't like movies about guys who grow potatoes in their own waste, then you might want to give it another thought. That's all. I'm just throwing that out there. I think it's got a lot going for
it.
But if that's a problem for you. You know, then it's going to be a problem. Because you gave me no heads up whatsoever that was going on.
Yeah, no, I did not. In fact, I was thinking, you know, I know Phil doesn't like movies about guys who grow potatoes in their own poop. And I think I'm going to just mess with him a little bit and send him to this movie anyway. So
yeah, you punked me. You totally, I fell for it, and there I went, so. Joke's on me. But, you know, that is kind of a subgenre, really. You think about all the great films on that topic. That little problem aside, I really just tremendously enjoyed it. I got to say, the thing I loved most about it, we saw it in the real 3D. That was the time that showtime that worked best for us. So we ended up seeing it in 3D. And I'm not a big fan of 3D. Okay.
Nor am I. Guys with glasses tend to hate it. And
there's that. On the outside and the inside, what do you do? I don't know. But the 3D is very well done. And I have to say that when we're on Mars, you know, if you just put the whole story aside for a moment, because I think it's a great story. I think it's an amazing piece of movie making, actually. But even if you put all that aside for a moment, just the experience of being on Mars and moving around on Mars is just breathtaking. It's just amazing. It looks
like a place we ought to go, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, actually, having seen the movie, I kind of feel like I've almost sort of been there, which is,
that's a test. You know, that's really a testimony to the movie too, isn't it? It kind of puts you there.
Yeah. I mean, when I saw Avatar, right, there was this feeling of being taken into another world, and that was fun because it's this totally fantasy world. I mean, mostly plausible science fiction, but completely made up world. But when you get taken into Mars in this movie, you're being taken into a place that's really there, you know. And I can only assume that the artwork is based on actual pictures from the satellites and the landers, and you know, we're maybe not seeing exactly Mars as it is, but boy, it was close. And it was as close as you can come, I think, to visiting another planet without actually visiting another planet. So just for that experience alone, I recommend going to see it. And although I'm not usually a fan, check out the 3D. In fact, Stephen, you might want to go see it again in 3D. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Well, I am planning to see it again. I'm taking my dad. You know, I've got him convinced. You know, Dad, you got to see this. It's great. And so, and I think every one of my boys are up for, you know, round two. And so, yeah, we might check it out in 3D. Of course,
yeah.
I'm really going to have to sell them on it. They hate 3D about as bad as I do. So, we'll see. We'll have a conversation about it anyway. So,
yeah,
I'm glad
you
like it. You
got to let them know about the potatoes.
I knew you were going to.
I did read something really interesting. I was checking out the science on it, and it's gotten really good reviews in terms of handling the science accurately. The movie. I'm sure the book even more so, because as you said, the credentials of the guy who wrote the book. Also, the story behind the authoring of the book is pretty interesting. If you've read up on that, you know, the guy essentially wrote it as a bunch of blog posts, which then became chapters that he sold on Amazon, which finally became a book that he sold on Amazon. But as he went, iteratively, he had commenters on his blog helping him out with the science. He knew some space stuff pretty well, but he didn't know chemistry. And, you know, a lot of the tricks that our hero, that the Matt Damon character, has to pull off in order to survive. It's really this amazing story of a man using very limited resources and tremendous ingenuity to keep himself alive. A lot of those tricks came from dialogue that the author had with people who read his blog and responded to it. So it's interesting, almost kind of collaborative effort between himself and his readers to create the book.
Crowdsourced in a way.
In a sense, yeah. The science part was crowdsourced. Also, I guess it just went viral. You know, it's suddenly when it became a full book on Amazon, everybody started reading it, and that's when he got approached by a conventional publisher and sold the movie rights in the same week. So this guy who started out writing some blog posts, after the book was finished, you know, became a millionaire, right? The following week, to the point where he started getting these offers, and he thought it must be all some kind of scam, he said. And
yeah.
It happened that fast. But anyway.
Would that something as nice happen to our good friend PJ Manning, right? So we're hoping for you, PJ. We hope something as nice happens with PJ Manning and her awesome book.
Absolutely.
So we got our fingers crossed for you, PJ.
For PJ and for Ramez as well. Yeah, absolutely.
Now,
the thing I read, okay, this is, by and large, you know, I've seen Neil deGrasse Tyson says, yep, they get most of the science right. Everybody's saying, yeah, they get most of the science right. Something I read that isn't quite true. So there's a little bit of a spoiler here, folks. It's not huge, but a little bit of a spoiler. Apparently, you know, the atmosphere is so thin on Mars that the dust storms that they do have, they really do have dust storms on Mars. This has been observed by satellites, and I guess we've got, you know, still pictures of things happening off in the distance and stuff like that. Dust storms on Mars play a huge foundational part of the story. But I guess the atmosphere is so thin on Mars that even the strongest wind on Mars would only feel like a breeze to us. So
yeah.
This is...
It's not enough to... Not enough to blow projectiles.
Wreak the damage that gets, yeah.
Yeah, and it gets wrought and or topple over, you know, 2-ton spaceships that are, you know, that was about to topple over, as you recall. So yeah, I read the same article and what's funny is that the author said, you know what, they're exactly right, and we made that. For purposes of the story, we made that concession to science. You know, science conceded on that one point for purposes of the story, and you can see you wouldn't have that story without that concession. And
you
so, got to
get the ball rolling somehow in this story, conceive of a way to set it up so that I'm sorry if you don't know this much, folks listening, that a man gets left alone on Mars. I mean, something big has to happen.
Yeah, some reason, unless it's Sheldon Cooper and they just got tired of it, you know.
Right.
It wasn't going to happen barring some sort of catastrophic event. But there's just not enough wind to have caused that on the real Mars. So, hey, I'm going to give them that point. I'm gonna allow that one to slide because so much of the rest of it's so good as far as the science goes, and the story itself is just excellent. And I very much enjoyed it.
Yeah, same here. Same here. Thanks for the recommendation, Stephen. I figured I'd see it eventually. But we go to the movies so rarely. I probably would have waited for it on TV. And I'm very glad that I went to see it in the theater. And although I thought I was having to settle for something at the time, I'm really glad I saw it in 3D. And I recommend that to anyone who wants to take a little trip to Mars. Frankly, it's worth doing, even if you don't like adventure stories, if you don't like science fiction stories, if you just want to actually experience being someplace else, give it a try. I think it's well worth it, and a really fun movie too. Matt Damon does a great job, and it's a clever script. A few little surprises along the way, and some good-natured fun things that happen to sort of keep you engaged. The conceit that he's continuing to update the video logs of the station that he's been left behind in allows him to have dialogue and allows him to keep talking without being a crazy man. And I think it works quite effectively. Also, for a small part, I thought Jeff Daniels as the head of NASA was awesome. Just really enjoyed really enjoyed his performance. Oh, one other thing, and this is total spoilers, so turn it off. But we got to geek out on this point, okay? Did you notice that in the scene where they talked about Lord of the Rings?
I know what you're about to say. Yeah, it was Sean Bean. It said it was the Council of Elrond.
Yeah, Sean Bean had nothing to say about it, right? He was just sitting there.
He said he's the one. He's the one that piped up and said it was the Council of Elrond.
Oh, he did say that. Wouldn't it have been funnier if he'd been the one who just knew nothing about it?
He knew everything about it, and we.
It would have been awesome if, like, instead of the female character. I mean, I understand stereotypically why they had to do that. And she says, "I hate you guys," right? And I've been in situations like that far too many.
Timothy, who was sitting next to me, saw, you know, when he came on the screen the first time they were introducing Sean Bean's character. He leaned over to me and said, "Well, how is he going to die in this movie?" He's on Earth. He's not even in danger. What's going on?
Yeah, exactly.
He's got a poor track record for surviving his films.
Well, in fantasy settings, especially. Yeah, maybe he does better in science fiction.
Yeah.
But
I will not spoil whether he survives this movie or not. You'll just have to go see it, folks. So.
Exactly. Yeah, we won't give that away. In fact, we're gonna. Well, you know what? We got a few other things we need to talk about tonight, so we'll move
Absolutely.
On from The Martian. But let's talk about our actual topic. The show this evening is called Under Construction, and this is a story that has kind of blown up. You know, we're talking about a really hot topic tonight, Stephen. Just coincidentally.
Yeah. You know, it's often that we maybe feel like we're the only people in the world that are talking about some of the things that we talk about, but not this. This is all over.
Well, a lot of times
Facebook,
we're the only people talking about something yet. You know, a lot of times we're you know the first ones, but this one has really captured.
Talking about it.
That's right. That's
You're
right.
Welcome.
But you don't have to thank us. We do it for the joy. This has really picked up some momentum, even since last night when I Facebooked something on it. I'm not saying it picked up momentum because of me. It hardly got any response at all on my Facebook page. But I'm saying that, you know, I saw it and I was like, hey, that's interesting. And I shared the link. But it's just everywhere now. Everyone is talking about this. What are they talking about? They're talking about an amazing, potentially an amazing discovery made by the, which is it? It's not the Hubble. It's the other space telescope, the Kepler Space Telescope.
Kepler.
Yeah, the one that's looking at the stars. It's been looking at this area of space for quite some time, and this one particular star, which is out there in the northern hemisphere sky, above the Milky Way, we've got two constellations, Cygnus the Swan and Lyra the Harp, and somewhere between those two, there's a star that is not visible to the naked eye, Kepler can see it. And the astronomers, first actually the citizen scientists, citizen astronomers who have been working on this project of looking for anomalous characteristics in stars, observed some odd things about it. Then the astronomers started looking at it.
Isn't that cool? I mean, isn't that, even that point of the story I just love. It's just normal people going through this because they found that so far, right now, the human brain still is the best thing for finding patterns. And these guys, these normal citizen scientists, is what they, you know, they're referring to them as, these normal guys with a computer and an internet connection, were looking through this stuff and saying, this is strange. And it kept, and several of them marked it, right, as something that should be looked at. And that's exactly right. Yeah.
It's cool that the role of the citizen scientist doesn't appear to be in any imminent danger. We talk about deep learning and machine learning a lot, and amazing things are happening with that, with computers being able to detect patterns as well as, and in some instances, better than people. But there's some stuff still that you don't want to farm out to the servers that you want human eyes on, and this apparently is an example of one of those things. So yeah, I think you defined the citizen scientist very well, Stephen. Somebody with a computer, and an internet connection, and a certain amount of time on their hands, right? I mean, that's the other thing you need, and a willingness to look for things. And what these folks found is odd, to say the least. What you've got is you've got a star that light from the star is periodically blocked. It's blocked by something, and by something I don't mean an object necessarily, but potentially a whole lot of objects or a whole lot of big objects or a whole lot of stuff orbiting this star and kind of winking out the light from it. Now, that in and of itself isn't particularly unusual. This is how we know planets exist, right? We look for this difference between how a star looks at one moment and how it looks at another moment and how it looks a week from now, and that's how we track planets. And this is one of the this is one of the ways that planets are being discovered right now.
And scientists can tell the difference between a young star, and that's what you would expect to see, a cloud of dust and debris that hasn't coalesced into planets around a young star. And we know what young stars look like. They have a different signature, but this, when it's not being obscured by whatever it is that's close to it, they can tell it's a mature star, and that's really strange. That's a really strange thing. So what are they talking
about?
It's
apparently a mature star. I mean, this is interesting. If it were a young star, it seems to not be in the right place for a young star to be, and it's not emitting, I think it was the proper infrared signature for a young star. So if it is a young star, it's a very weird young star that just doesn't fit the pattern. So they've kind of moved it out of that box for the time being. It's like, well, we've never seen a new star act like this. Yes, a new star would have, as you said, Stephen, this big coalescing cloud of stuff circling it. That stuff would be, that dust and those particles would be, coming together, forming planets, and that's a real thing that happens. But it doesn't have the age. It doesn't look like it's the right age for that to be happening to it right now. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Right. Well, when it's young, it gives off more infrared light.
Yeah.
It has to do with the dust. Okay, this is not doing that. And so they're looking at it and saying, okay, appears to be a mature star that is being blocked by a bunch of stuff periodically, right? And and why is that exciting people so much? I mean, this is just some sort of strange eclipse thing going on. Why do we care? Well, because it would tend to... there's things that could be other than what I'm about to suggest, but this is what you would expect to see if you were going to be looking for megastructures that an intelligent race would build. And what are we talking about? We're talking about a Dyson Sphere, or probably more accurately, a Dyson Swarm, because Dyson Spheres are probably not possible, not the way they were envisioned in Star Trek and other science fiction programs. It just, the gravity problem doesn't work out right. But with a Dyson Swarm, a swarm of things that just completely, you know, harvest all of the light energy from a star by putting enough stuff orbiting around it in all sorts of orbits, including equatorial orbits, polar orbits, and everything in between, you could completely harvest the energy of a star and use it to, for computation or whatever you need it for. And so that's, it's looked a little bit like that. And so it's got a lot of people excited.
Well, it's you know, if it's that or anything even remotely like that, obviously, it's the discovery of all time, right? It's the it's the greatest astronomical discovery that we'll ever witness, or you know, one of the, you know, the start of something really big. Put it that way. But yeah, just to cover a couple of these terms for those who aren't familiar, a Dyson sphere would be a spherical structure that completely encircles a star. And in fact, I don't think we would ever actually, those would be extremely hard to detect, right? Because
it would be a ball that would completely, a hollow ball that, you know, encapsulates a star. And if you make it big enough, you know, where the inside of the ball is 93 million miles from that star, right? Then, you know, you'd have the surface of the inside of that ball would be the same distance as the Earth to the sun. And you know, so you could potentially make the whole thing habitable. There's lots of problems with that. How do you get the gravity to work? Well, you know, do you spin it to make gravity? And if so, how do you keep it from collapsing at the poles? An actual Dyson sphere does not seem to work. The math does not work out. But a Dyson swarm, and George Dvorsky has got some ideas about how we would do that in our own solar system, dismantle Mercury and then make a swarm of, using the materials from dismantling Mercury, we make a swarm of space stations, basically, that a network of space stations at the right distance from the sun to collect all of the sun's energy. So, maybe that's what we're seeing.
Potentially, could be. As you know, astounding as it sounds, could be, that's one possibility for what we're seeing. The fact that we are seeing it indicates that it's probably not an actual, you know, it couldn't be, as you said, there's a lot of objections to the idea of a sphere. Assuming someone could figure out those objections, if there were a Dyson sphere out there, it would be very hard to find, right? Kepler wouldn't be able to find one of those because you don't see the star ever, right? It would be completely enclosed within the star. A swarm, I think, sounds like you might have a similar problem, right? You might have so much stuff orbiting that star that you'd never see it, right? You know, the star would be...
It depends on how thick your swarm is, I guess, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It depends on where you are in the process of getting that swarm put together. So one of the things I suggested here is, okay, well, so maybe the Dyson sphere or swarm was, you know, quite a thing a billion years ago or so, and now that civilization is long gone, and what we're seeing is the ruins of some huge megastructure built by an ancient alien civilization. Or we're on the other end of that process. Maybe they're just getting it built now. Maybe we see a swarm in process, or maybe, you know, a 40% swarm, it turns out, is the best use of a star, you know, for engineering reasons that we can't fathom quite yet. You don't really want to go any more than whatever this thing is eclipsing the star, you know, 20%, 30%, 40%.
Maybe the planet they decided to dismantle to make their swarm in that solar system, it's not quite as big as Mercury, so it's not going to completely encapsulate the star. Maybe it's some sort of technical reason like that. Who knows? But
they've got to find another planet, and it turns out Earth is the perfect size. Oh, there's your plot
oh,
right
gosh.
There.
Well,
for this story?
Well, you know, they say there's other, you know, there's other possible explanations that don't involve little green men. And they said one could be a rogue star passed through this system and just really screwed things up, leaving a bunch, you know, a bunch of comet material and all kinds of things, maybe even causing a the sort of maybe a planetary collision on par with maybe what happened between the Earth and the Moon could cause something like this. And you know, so there's other potential less exciting explanations for this, but hey, it seems to me that we shouldn't rule this out as a possibility, but it could potentially
Here's what's interesting to me about that particular theory, the comet theory, because I've downloaded this paper that they refer to where they talk about the possible explanations for what this thing is. I haven't read it yet. I've just read the abstract. But they go through a number of possible scenarios for how you get this old star with this seemingly fresh cloud of weird stuff around it. And as you said, the one that they can't completely rule out is one star passed close to this star, and it's like this star just inherited all the comets somehow, right? The other star kind of left behind a lot of matter, and so you've got this you've got this, you know, this massive cataclysmic event. It could be the other star was damaged, the other star was wiped out. There's various ways this could rain out. But what you're seeing is the aftermath of a cataclysm. Now, one of the interesting arguments against this is that this kind of freaks me out a little bit. Because of the time scale for how long the universe lasts and the time scale for how long something like that would be visible in the lifetime of a star overall, it's very unlikely that we would ever see one of those. Okay? If you're just pointing a telescope out at stars and then the first 150,000 stars you point at, you see one of those, you have really lucked out.
It's like
out.
Winning the lottery. Okay. You've won the lottery, yeah.
You have really lucked out. But I have to say, that being the case, since we have no idea what the odds are of there being aliens building megastructures, you know, the probability argument has to probably, you know, be at least as effective against that as it is against the star close passing theory. You know, maybe not. Maybe every, you know, 20 light years there's a civilization trying to build a megastructure. We haven't seen them yet. Because they're all perfectly hermetically smooth and invisible, but
something seriously weird is going on here. I think that's safe to say. Something odd and extraordinary is happening, and it's just the question is, what odd and extraordinary thing are we looking at? And it's going to be exciting. What they're going to do, Phil? Are they talking about pointing some radio telescopes at it and listening hard for a while, see if there's any interesting radio coming?
That's right. The next step is they're going to, as you said, aim the very large array in New Mexico, that huge radio telescope, right at this star, which, by the way, is never named. I don't know if it just only has a number, if it has a name, but this star deserves a name. Okay, somebody needs to come up with a good name for this star. They're going to aim it at this and look for interesting radio signature. It's not that we're looking necessarily for radio broadcast from outer space, but looking for any kind of radioactivity, any kind of unusual signature in that spectrum that indicates machinery or that indicates, you know, something other than what we normally associate with the kind of radio emissions from natural phenomena. So anything weird there will add to the weirdness and potentially suggest that maybe there actually is something going on there along those lines. As incredible as that seems, and as unlikely as that probably is, it's intriguing, and I don't know. It's kind of exciting that whatever it is they've found here, they found it. I really look forward to learning more about this in the weeks to come. I think it's actually going to be about what's it going to be, a few months before they start aiming the radio telescopes at it. Let's see, in January it's going to be, and then a follow-up coming next fall. So, you know, in a few months, maybe we'll hear more about this, and then in a year or so, perhaps we'll hear a bit more. But we're not going to know anything for sure for quite a while. That seems safe to say. Whatever's happening there, it's going to remain a mystery for quite some time. I just hope the mystery deepens. I think that would be extremely fun if it did.
You know, I wish we could get a closer look at this star. Some, you know, get some eyeballs on it that would really bring this into focus a little more. You know, what I would expect to see, Phil, if you could look close enough, is that you know, if this is something that is a Dyson swarm, for example, then I would expect that the things that are swarming the star would be round, and I mean like a circle, not round like a ball, round like a circle, two dimensional circle. And the reason for it is, you know, that's, you know, that would be the shape that would be probably most useful for a space station. You would you'd have a space station that you'd be rotating for gravity, artificial gravity, and then the space in between inside the circle would be the collectors for for solar, maybe. That's one possible design. So what if we were, you know, we looked at this thing and we saw, okay, it's we see things eclipsing the sun, but as they move in their orbit around the sun, it goes from being round to an eclipse or an ellipse because it's two-dimensional. Rather, you see what I'm saying?
Right.
It's blocking less of these individual things are blocking less of the light as they move from, you know, directly between you and the star to over to the side of the star. They would because they're two-dimensional, and they would go from being looking round to looking like an ellipse. And
yeah, I would
say
if you detect even one,
if you saw something like that,
if you detect even one planet-sized disk out in space, right? Because there's no natural way you get a disk, right? I mean, it's like
you could have an asteroid
that is kind of flat, but it can't be that big. Once things get big enough, they turn into spheres, right? So
if you see a disk
out there, something's going on. And if you see like three or four disks,
that's artificial.
Yeah. That is not a shape that we know of that nature creates out in space. You know, there are disk-shaped things terrestrially, but astronomical objects really come in one shape, you know, after a certain size.
After a certain point, they get round real quick.
We
can thank gravity for that. So, yeah, if we detect a disk, you know, encircling a star at any point, we can feel pretty comfortable that something artificial is going on there. And that'd be pretty cool to go looking for. So,
hey, what is George?
Who did look for.
We should have him on the show and talk about this. What does George Dvorsky say about the ring world? Did you ever read that, Larry Niven? You know, it's not a whole disk going around a planet. You just got a ring going all the way around, right?
That works a little better for gravity purposes because with a ring, if you were to make a Dyson sphere and then you try to rotate it for purposes of making gravity, you would only make gravity at the equator of the inside of this hollow sphere. You know, at the poles, you'd still have no gravity at all, right? So a ring solves that problem.
Hmm.
You would, but, you know, you'd still, it, there'd still have to be the structural strength of whatever you would build to, or your ring out of, would have to be beyond anything that we currently know of or even theoretically can imagine. I think we're going to be stuck unless we can bend the laws of the universe. I think we're going to be stuck with a Dyson swarm as the ultimate. So
you and George are just like so stuck in the 21st century. It's really sad. And people will they
drag
will listen to this
broadcast.
Podcast years from now, and they'll just say, "Oh, that's so funny! Yeah, there was no way to make a sphere." That's
right.
Those guys couldn't.
And I want to call the other side of this dice sphere that I'm living in, and talk to my buddy, and we're gonna have a big laugh about this. So.
Exactly. That's people will get this recording out to embarrass you with it, Stephen. In a few hundred years.
Well, if I could live to see it, I'll take the embarrassment. That'd be great.
Not George, though. He won't be embarrassed. He'll just be like, all those guys never understood what I was talking about anyway. So
yeah, that's right.
He'll just blow us off. But so there it is. It's an amazing. No matter what else it is, it's an amazing discovery. It's something new. And it speaks to the kinds of cool stuff that hopefully we'll be seeing a lot more of, you know, that Kepler is kind of coming into its own now, exploring the universe in its own way. Hubble had all those years of giving us these amazing dramatic pictures, and, you know, now we got Kepler out there just kind of plugging along, getting a lot of data and making its own discoveries. Who knows
what
we're
cool
going to find
Kepler
next out in the universe.
You know what's cool about Kepler is that, you know, in the story they said Kepler's been looking at the star for 4 years. Well, I'm going, well, that seems like a bit of a waste. I mean, what about all the other stars in the universe? Well, if you read the next sentence, is, and it's looking at all the other stars, too.
Yeah.
It's like how many, you know, Kepler can look in all directions at the same time and be monitoring, you know, hundreds of thousands of stars, apparently. It's crazy. So what a fantastic space observatory that is.
An amazing piece of technology, absolutely.
Yeah.
And look forward to what it tells us next. Keep plugging away, Kepler. We can't wait to see what you've got to share with us next. Okay, well, we've got a few other things to talk about tonight. Obviously, that was our big story for the evening, but a few other amazing developments going on in the world. Did you see this video, Stephen, of the self-driving truck on the Autobahn?
I'm a sucker for this stuff, Phil. So yeah, I saw it. It's amazing. The technology for auto drive vehicles is progressing, it seems, by leaps and bounds. You know, I've told family members this is the sort of thing that, you know, there goes Steve being Steve again. You know, when I tell people, the normal people in my family, I tell them about things like auto drive cars. Need to get ready. These things are happening. They will, you know, they'll be here inside of just a few years. Look at me and shake their head. Anyway, haha, it's happening. It's happening very, very quickly. It's like the technology needed to reach a certain critical mass in computation. And once it gets there, then you know, boom, you got it pretty quick, apparently. And it looks like we're getting there very quickly with this stuff.
Well, to me this is really interesting because a couple of years ago, Daimler-Benz was, you know, they were talking about they were doing concept self-driving cars and they were experimenting with the technology and we've heard of U.S. automakers doing that and Tesla's talking about it and putting cars out and there's been a lot of that activity around the consumer side of it and. That's immediately where our minds go when we think about cars. We think about our car and how we drive around. But, you know, the automobile industry is more than just consumers driving cars. there's this whole other side to it, which is, you know, commercial transportation. And Daimler, I think, probably makes a lot of money in that area. And the fact that they're putting together a self-driving truck tells you that they're interested not just in PR.
We're talking about an 18-wheeled big rig commercial long hauler is what we're talking about here.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, this is the convergence of things. This is the convergence of people starting to take this idea seriously and the recognition that long-haul freight is like just, you know, a killer app for a self-driving vehicle. You know, getting out on the big highway – where even just with cruise control, there's been a sort of autopilot kind of driving going on for quite a while now anyway, you know, much to the detriment of a lot of people's health and to their lives. But, you know, the bottom line is highways are, you know, they're wider. They're usually a little bit roomier. This kind of thing can go on at night. There's a lot of reasons why it's not – urban heavy traffic driving. It's a completely different set of problems to solve. In some ways, a little bit closer to the original DARPA challenge, right? Getting a truck from one place to another. It's a lot simpler than that, of course, because you've got all the technology that's come along since those early, very primitive days of self-driving vehicles. But you know, I think people are looking at that and they're saying, well, I don't know when self-driving cars for humans are going to come along, but I think we're going to see self-driving freight sooner. I really think that will that idea will kick in, just because it's it seems so commercially viable to have something like that. To have a truck where the driver never gets tired, doesn't care if he drives all night and then drives back the next day. I mean, you can just do the math in your head. Obviously, it's not great news for truck drivers to talk in these kinds of terms, but who's never going to get in a wreck, right? At least unless somebody else slams into him or it, I should say. It's just the business case, I guess, is what I'm saying for a self-driving vehicle really starts to present itself here, and I think it's going to become a lot more clear very soon. And I don't make a lot of predictions, but I think we're going to see self-driving delivery before we see self-driving passenger cars.
They tested this big rig on an autobahn in Germany. Is that right, Phil?
That's right. Yeah. And in the video, it's very interesting. There's a driver there, and in fact, the concept vehicle that they have, you still have to have a driver. Because in heavy weather, or if something just goes wrong, if the system just goes south, the driver has to take over. And if the driver doesn't take over, then the vehicle stops. So basically, you could eliminate the need for a truck driver 99% of the time, but still employ a truck driver. So basically, a truck driver could be somebody who, gets to sit and watch videos all night long, or
play
catch
video
up on
games
his reading
or whatever.
Or something like that, because the truck is really going to do all the work. And the engineers at Daimler say, even at this very early stage, they're looking at a system that is 10, 20 times more reliable than a human being. Which is only going to go in one direction and become more so. So yeah, I think it's very cool to see. I'd be kind of scared actually if I was out on the highway and I saw a big truck going by. I mean, it's kind of scary anyway. Anytime a big truck goes past you, but wouldn't it be a little unnerving, right? If there was nobody driving it, right? A big 18-wheeler goes past you. Look up and
If the person that's sitting in the driver's seat is turned looking at you with both hands on the window, what the heck is going on?
Never once looks ahead. Yeah, never once touches the wheel. That would freak you out.
Well,
a little bit,
you know, if I were the first driver of one of those rigs, I'd be tempted to do stuff like that just to mess people up.
Maybe
hang out
the
window.
Yeah.
Exactly. Roll down the window and have another steering wheel. Hang out the window with holding a steering wheel. You can come up with all kinds of things. But
absolutely. A lot of possibilities there. Anyway, it's more vindication.
Hilarity
will see. And one of the topics I forgot to add to our agenda tonight is that MIT is now. Is now giving degrees to people who take their online courses. That seems like something that you could have predicted a while back, and now here it is happening.
It is. It's the coffee shopification of education. Hey, did you see that Volvo, the CEO of Volvo, said this amazing thing? He's the president, not the CEO of Volvo. Said, basically saying, we'll take responsibility if these systems cause accidents. It'll be on us. And that is,
I have not seen that. Amazing.
Let's see. Here's the exact quote: "If we made a mistake in designing the brakes or writing the software, it's not reasonable to put the liability on the customer," said Erica, talking about these autonomous systems, of course. It says, this guy, he says, we say to the customer, you can spend your time on something else. We take responsibility.
Wow.
And that makes
wow.
Volvo the first car maker to issue something so bold about, you know, about their auto drive systems. That's amazing.
That is impressive. You know, I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
I'd like to imagine an American executive
yeah.
saying something like that. I can't get my head around a statement like that coming from the head of a company. That's awesome. Good for him.
Yeah.
And good for us. Because, you know, if everyone else doesn't step up and take that position, I guess Volvo's going to own this market, aren't they?
That's right. So, I mean, you know what that tells me? It tells me that they are convinced in the safety of their own product. And it comes down to this. Again, I've said this in this, several times on the show, but it does not need to be a perfect system. It just needs to be as good as a reasonably good driver. If
right.
it's as good as a reasonably good driver, then or better, then it is reasonable for them to to sell it this way, and they say, yeah, this is. In fact, don't worry about the road. We got it. And
well, like we've talked about before. I mean, if you want to put it in the most crass terms, 10% better would save 3,000 to 5,000 lives a year, right?
Yeah.
Bottom line.
So in other words, you know, these systems could kill 40,000 people a year, maybe a little less. It'd be more like, in the mid 30,000 people a year. And it would be like the best news ever because it would have saved so many lives. It would be that much
exactly.
better than we are behind the wheel. And quite frankly, even if they're just as good as a normal driver, the problem, don't you think the problem of drunk driving kind of goes away? You know, it seems to me that the problem of drunk driving kind of goes away with these systems. Because, you know, I mean, you don't drive when you're drunk. I mean,
right.
the thing that makes people, that tempts people to drive while intoxicated is the fact that I'm not home. You know,
they have to get somewhere.
And here I am at the bar. They told me you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here because it's closing time, right? And
right.
I'm drunk, and there's my car, and looks like I'm gonna I'm taking a chance. I'm going. That's the temptation. But you know, what if the other option is, you know what? the car's gonna have to drive it this time. I'm engaging the system, and I'm gonna take a little nap. Wake me up when I'm in the driveway. You know,
yeah.
That's imagine how many. It doesn't have to be a system that's hugely better than normal drivers to save thousands, because most fatalities are caused by intoxicated driving. And if you remove the temptation to drive intoxicated because you have that system in place, that's the vast number of drunk driving accidents will just not happen.
There's probably some data somewhere to show that to a much lesser extent, Uber is already providing some of that benefit, right? Because people
that's
are
right. And I'm
that's
sure that,
become
I'm sure
like
that.
This go-to service for people getting home from clubs and bars on weekends, where before they might have driven, where taxis weren't really much of an option for them, and suddenly now there is an option. But people like having their own car, and
go get their car out of not having to drag themselves back up the following day to pick up their car at the club. You know, now the car's in the driveway, and I didn't drive drunk, and everybody's
right.
safe. So
if the car drives only as well as you do, it drives so much better than you do when you're drunk. That's the bottom line. Right? It never gets
drunk. There's a PSA. Made a PSA right there.
I think so.
Yeah, the car's only as good as you when it's auto driving, but it's 10 times better than you drunk, mister. So engage.
There you go.
If you've been drinking, engage the system, dude. So
that is the advantage.
Yeah.
Okay, real quick, we got two other topics we're gonna touch on here. One is a really exciting bit of news about. Potentially about life extension. Now, for some reason, I can't find the link. I just had it open, and I was going to...
Well, it's from Science Alert, and scientists map genes that extend life by as much as 60% if deleted. these are not genes that we need to engage. These are genes that we need to, you know, turn off. And so, you know, my issue with this is with this possibility is this, Bill. Sometimes we age as a way to fight cancer. And what am I mm-hmm. talking about? I'm talking about, you know, rather than allow our cells to just continue on and on and on, although they are wearing out, they tend to go cancerous on us under those circumstances. So we have systems in place to destroy those cells or to tell them to senesce, to, you know, and to die off. And that's part of the aging process. That's not all of the aging process, but that's part of it right here. So, you know, maybe if we turned off these systems, we would run the risk of further cancer. But, you know, that hasn't been what they found in yeast, which is what they've been working with. Is that correct?
That's right. And I don't know how big of a problem cancer is for yeast, right? That might be the difference. I mean,
it might not be a problem at all for yeast. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things they talk about is, well, don't let the fact that it's yeast fool you, that, in fact, we got a lot more chemically in common with yeast than we would care to admit to ourselves. That's the the bottom line. And in fact, the fact that it's effective for them is fairly indicative that it might be at least somewhat effective for us, although, you know, we would like to believe we're, you know, infinitely different from yeast. But, you know, the cancer thing is not mentioned, and I think you make a great point there, Stephen, which is that this kind of gene research, we're really going to have to thread the needle carefully. We might go through a process where we're switching some things off, switching some things back on, and also saying, okay, well, looks like we found some good ways to stop aging. Now we got to find alternative ways to stop cancer, right? Because our body's way of stopping cancer kills us, you know, this through this long, drawn out process. So, you know, this might not be the beginning of the end. You know, maybe it's the end of the beginning or something like that. Maybe we're, you know, it's a very early step, but an encouraging one. You know, when you start talking about extending life by 60%, which is not twice as long, so the answer to my question in the show notes is no. We haven't found a way to make people live twice as long. But even 60%, that's a nice boost. And you know, I think people will take it. People will take they'll take 10% if we're talking about adding life with quality of life, right? If we're actually talking about slowing down senescence and extending health span, making people live longer and healthier lives. Yeah, you know, who wants to hurry up cancer, right? That's that's the fear. It's like, yeah, we've turned off we've turned off all these drugs. Your body's not going to age, but you've just stepped on the gas for cancer. That's a bad deal.
I left a beautiful corpse though. That's a little dark humor there, but yeah, that's the issue. You know, I mean, we got to obviously we have to proceed with caution, but let's proceed, Phil, by all means. As I get deeper in the middle age here, I'm I'm all for this kind of research.
Well, yeah, I don't know if you've seen the story going around about the governor of California who is, you know, come out in favor essentially of assisted suicide, but who has opposed the try before you die law, the thing that lets terminal patients try experimental drugs. You know, it's just crazy. It's like, well, why don't you let people try things? You know, if you think it's okay to die, surely it would be okay to, you know, learn something along the way, you know, to at least have given something a shot.
Yeah, that doesn't even compute, does it?
It really doesn't. I really think, well, you know,
it sounds
old Jerry
like
Brown.
He's
not getting any younger himself,
there's a lobby for one and maybe not for the other. That's what I have to think.
But I would urge Governor Brown, in my rare call out to a political figure, I would urge him to, you know, reconsider his thinking on that. To guys like us, it doesn't make a lot of sense, and we think about these things all the time. So Jerry, if you're listening, by any chance, straighten out. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
But There you go. I think this is encouraging. Yes, people aren't yeast. We could be heading down a road of unintended consequences, but it's a good, encouraging first step. We're going to have to thread the needle on this, but stay tuned. I think gene research is going to show us some pretty exciting stuff where fighting aging is concerned. Our final story, this is actually just this slash dot discussion about what non-lethal technology has the best chance of replacing the gun. I just like that this has become, I don't know that slash dot is mainstream by any chance, but this is a show we did, 5 years ago, right? And
we've
done it a few times since then. Glad to see this idea getting some attention. Obviously, it's slash dot. The discussion goes immediately political, and it goes into a bunch of ridiculous directions. But I think it's interesting that people are thinking in these terms. The question is phrased other than the way I would phrase it, because the guy asks, how do we replace the gun so that police won't get killed? I'm like, no. How do you replace the gun so I don't get killed? Right. That's kind of my big concern.
Because
not that I'm not worried about the cops,
for my wallet. Yeah, I'm reaching for my wallet to give them my driver's license, and they decide I'm going for a gun, and all of a sudden I'm dead. They're put on administrative leave, and they're sad about that. But it's I'm being cynical. Cops don't want to kill innocent people, and innocent people don't want to die. And so
And speaking as one, I don't want to get shot by a cop or anybody else. My thing is, I want something that's effective against anybody who wants to point a firearm at me. But anyway, it's an interesting topic. I'm starting to think that the future may actually, the guy throws out suggestions. Is it going to be drones? Some kind of foam, some kind of body armor. These are all interesting ideas. And he says robots. And I'm thinking,
I think it's going to be a gun of some sort. It's just a non-lethal gun. And I would say one of the more interesting things I have seen is the taser makes shotgun shells. The taser.
Mm-hmm.
You put it into any standard shotgun that's of that gauge, when you fire it, it fires like a conventional shotgun shell. It takes, there's a small amount of gunpowder, enough to project this taser module out, and then it strikes with clips that actually pierce the skin of the person you're wanting to tase, and then tases them. And the combination of the impact of that, which I have to think is going to be a pretty big punch in the in
mm-hmm.
the gut or wherever, and the tase, you'd have to be a pretty tough guy to continue going at that point. So that to me I find interesting. If they could shrink that down to where it would fit inside of a 45 or a 38 caliber bullet, so it can be fired by a tiny taser could be fired by a conventional revolver or pistol. That to me would be that's where it would get really, really interesting to me. I like how you phrased it in the show description, Phil. I like how you phrased it, less lethal, because And that's what they have to tell. And that's what they train the cops. When you use a taser, you're not, one of these other things. It's not non-lethal. It's not a harmless thing. It's something
what I want to do is I want to take what you're suggesting, and the one piece you're missing, Stephen, is then I want to put that in the hands of a robot. Okay, because I still don't want to get shot by the thing you just described, and. I know a robot won't shoot me, but if someone's trying to shoot me, the robot will use that thing you just described on that person. So, like self-driving cars.
Take them down. Yeah.
Next step after that, I believe, is going to be RoboCops. I think every building has a fire extinguisher.
The advantage of a RoboCop is it doesn't have to worry about its own safety.
There you go.
Right.
It just worries about mine, which I like.
It absolutely. It only worries about the human citizenry. And so if a human citizen is in trouble or is is being threatened, only then does it pull out the, less lethal force, in the form of tiny taser bullets. And so that's, that'll be pretty cool.
That's the way to go. What's our music, Stephen?
All right. Our music tonight is from a band that we've played before. It is Steady Hustle singing Stick Around.
Stick Around by Steady Hustle. Thank you, Stephen, for putting that together. Thank you all for being with us. We'll be back with a brand new show again next week. And until next time, live to see it.
But it's not that I wanted to say goodbye. It's just the time you know. Then you're waiting with my impatience. It grows every day. With this feeling stuck, rocking a hard place, my channel about to change. But I guess I never really gave you a good enough, never a good enough reason to stay. And I guess I'll blame it on the bad timing of my life. And I let you fall apart in your pieces. Yeah, ooh, I've been doing my best and I let you fall apart in your pieces. I try to keep this consistent and keep it to myself. I let you.